Okay, welcome back. And before I continue with the truth-telling discussion, I want to give you your instructions for the writing exercise so that we don't have to lose any time. I'm going to do something a little different this afternoon, although I do want you to continue the process of creating your catalogs and then choosing items from the catalogs to expand and embellish and bring to life. That's actually something we're going to really do for the next couple of months. So we've done enough of it here, I think, but I want you to keep coming back to that. And that will be part of the writing practice for what we'll do in between the retreats. So setting up a schedule for yourself, ideally of writing every day, would be, of course, ideal. And then realistically, we can modify that depending on our life schedule. But try to stay, semi-regular, even if it's every other day, but some way that you are continuing to come back again and again to this practice of writing. Otherwise, you're going to get so far away from it that every time you come back, it's going to be working yourself back into where you were before. And that takes time. It takes time to get back into the flow of what you've been doing. The holidays are coming. So, of course, I'm fully aware that there are many, possibilities or probabilities that we will all end up kind of falling off the bandwagon from here and there. So don't worry about it too much, but you want to keep at it as much as possible. And for this afternoon, then the writing project for this afternoon begins with a drawing project. So you're going to want to have some paper to draw on, unless you're a really great graphic artist on your computer, which some of you might be, I don't know. And this exercise is not mine. I'm stealing it from a man named Dan Wakefield. But it's about how, again, it's another exercise in continuing to thicken memory and to bring memory back into the present moment. So this is starting now to work with childhood. And the exercise here is to draw a picture. And actually, it can be more like a,
pictogram.
It could be a pictogram. There's a certain word that I'm thinking of, but it's not coming back to me. You're going to draw your favorite room in the house that you grew up in. If you grew up in more than one house, you can choose the house with the happiest memories and the best associations. It could be your bedroom, it could be the living room, it could be the dining room, it could be the family room, but a room where you have a lot of, associative memories even now. And you're going to, possibly for some of us, family of origin home was not a place where we have very many happy memories or good associations. So then a room maybe in the home of a relative or in the home of a friend. But some space from your childhood that you can remember where you have some positive association, okay? Although, just to say that even if you don't have any room or anything you can come up with, and there's some examples around this of, there was, for example, one person wanted to draw their backyard because that was where they had the most positive associations. So you can be, somewhat creative with this. It could be the backyard, could be a schoolroom, could be... But if you can, someplace from your past that you're going to use to evoke memories of that particular time in your life. And, I'm now thinking like childhood, right? Like maybe, so let's say, from, the earliest you can remember until maybe 10 or 11 years old, something like that. And the idea here is that, of course, our memory is a treasure house of, or a storehouse. It's a storehouse of our memories that is intrinsically part of who we are, and we're working to kind of enliven that space and to bring those memories back up again. But sometimes unpleasant memories are also treasures. You know, they're also, especially when we examine them again from the perspective of where we are now, we can start to see perhaps the value in some of those more difficult memories. But, you know, I would aim you in the direction of positive associations for now. So draw, okay, floor plan. That was what I was trying to think of. You can draw a diagram, you can draw a floor plan, and show everything you can remember. Everything you can remember. So the furniture, where was it located, the pictures on the wall, what were they of, the rugs, the curtains, the, you know, if there were radios, televisions, toys, plants, bookcases, you know, windows, doors, your dresser, your closet, plants, fans, air conditioners, pets, maybe there's a pet that was in the room a lot with you, plants, perhaps. So you're really going to try to flesh out this room again, bring it back alive for you. And you can even, if you start to run out of ideas, you can start to think of, okay, what were the books on my bookshelf? You know, or what were my favorite television shows when I was, or radio shows even, radio, what kind of radio did you listen to? And then what I would suggest for that kind of thing is you just make a list around the side of the room, and then, you know, for example, if you've drawn where the bookcase was in a room and you can remember some of the books that were on that bookcase, then list the titles and draw an arrow pointing to the bookshelf, okay? You can also think about what was outside the windows. What did you see when you looked out the window? Right? What did you hear when the window was open? What kinds of sounds would come in through the window? And again, this is the kind of thing you can kind of draw around the edges of the diagram. And so continue to just fill the picture in, this picture in, until you feel you've captured as much of it as you can, as much of that time as you can. And then what we'll do, so that should... You know, I'm estimating that you might take about a half an hour for that. And before we leave the space today to write, I want you to identify one or two other people that you're then going to meet up with. And you're going to take them on a little tour through the room and describe everything that's in the room to them. Tell them all about it. You'll take turns doing that. And I think we have 29 people, so there's going to be one group of three. But otherwise, just finding one person. And maybe we should, well, we can do that. I'm trying to think when we should do that. Just so that when you leave here, you know where to go to find your person after a half an hour to share with, because you don't have to necessarily, or you could sit together if you want to as well. Might be easier, or sit nearby each other. Okay? So that's going to be the project for this afternoon. I'm beginning to, you know, flesh out the situation from our childhood. And it sounds kind of silly, but I think that we'll find that there's quite a lot that starts to reemerge into our memories when we do that kind of an exercise. Okay, so again, we're gathering material for putting together this spiritual autobiography. Any questions about that? Yeah. This doesn't have to be recorded.
I can't think of any one place, but I can think of two or three places. Can I kind of combine them?
Yeah, if you think you can do that, that's fine, I think. You know, it doesn't have to be just one place. It just, you know, you're going to have about a half an hour, so whatever you can get done in that period of time, then you can take your partner through on a little journey through the different places. And, you know, it might be a place in the natural world. I want to just put that out there as a possibility. I know for me as a child, I often felt really at home in certain places in the natural world, and so I would go to those places often, and I can still think of the details. But, you know, a room in a house or in a building of some kind tends to have more to populate it with. Anybody else? Question?
What was the sequence?
The
drawing, writing.
Well, you're just going to draw at this point. You're just going to draw. No, you know, no writing. I mean, you, of course, you're going to write. You can write the titles of books. You can write TV shows that you watched or radio shows that you heard. But again, these are just lists. So you're not writing any kind of paragraph or at this point. At this point, you're just kind of, you're just calling on memory to begin to populate this drawing that you're putting together, this floor plan of a room or more than one room, perhaps, if you need to do that, if you want to do that. Okay? Is that? And then you're going to explain that whole room. You're going to take your partner through the room and describe everything in the room to your partner, so that in a way you're making them feel as if they really they themselves know that space as well as you do. Okay? Questions? Okay. I mean, I hope it's a fun exercise. It sounds, I think it, I'm going to do it myself, so. And I've done it before, so.
Sorry, can you just, I know you said this, but could you just repeat, like, top to bottom logistics? Like, we go where, what o'clock, we do this, we need that, like.
I'm sorry, I cannot hear you.
Just the logistical part. We find a person, we arrange when to.
So before you break, before we break.
Yeah.
Find a person, somebody you're going to meet up with, take 30 minutes to do your diagram, and then sit down with your friend and take them through on a journey through your room. So you'll each have 15 minutes to take each other on a journey through your room. And then if it's a group of three, you might only have 10 minutes to take each other through the room. So you just have to do it a little more quickly, or you can just go a little bit later, 10 minutes later or something. Okay.
And if we don't have any paper?
Yeah, oh, so, I didn't think about that. Okay, so anyone who doesn't have paper, it seems like there is paper in here and notebooks and, you have paper? Or you need paper?
No.
You don't have paper?
I have paper.
You have paper, okay. There's also paper. I know that we could get paper out of the office as well. But ideally, we could just share paper. I didn't bring my notebook, but if anybody needs a piece of paper, can somebody raise their hand who's willing to offer a piece of paper? Okay, so lots of hands around you that. Lined paper is fine. I mean, you know, it's not like we're making a, you know, something we're going to have some fabulous piece of art here. It's just a way to. So why don't we do that right now? Why don't we make sure everyone has a piece of paper? And why don't you choose a partner?
Excuse me.
Yes. Sure, yeah. Whatever you think would, you know, help you. Yeah, absolutely.
What about those like me who just cannot draw?
Well,
I can do stick figures, that's the best.
That's fine, that's all you need to be able to do, right? It's a draw a floor plan. Floor plan is just lines, right? You can do that, yeah, okay, do that. Okay, you guys are the three? So, everybody, who does not yet have a partner? Okay, so Peter does not have a partner. Who else does not have a partner?
Did you say only two, or what is two?
Well, I mean, it doesn't have to be only two, but I thought we only had 29 people, so that would mean one group of three, and everyone else would be in pairs.
Is there a group of three already?
There is a group of three already. Grady, do you have a partner?
No.
Okay, so why don't you and Peter work together?
Okay.
Okay? Everybody else? have a partner? Anyone else need a piece of paper? Thank you so much for offering your paper. I should have thought of that beforehand. Okay. Thank you. Thank you, everybody, for being willing to dive in. I mean, you know, we'll see how this works. Okay. I want to come back to this notion of truth-telling, because we have kind of talked about it a little bit, but I'd like to go a little further with that. And, you know, basically what we're asking with this question of truth-telling is what kind of an ethical commitment are we taking up when we start writing a spiritual autobiography? What kind of an obligation to truth-telling, actually, are we taking up? That's really the question here. And then that question, what kind of obligation to truth-telling are we taking up, is connected to the question, what is our relationship with the narrator of our text, the I inside the world of the text? What kind of a relationship do I, as the author, have to the narrator that I'm bringing into, that I'm creating with inside the world of this text? Because this narrator, the I, if it is a first person narrator within the text, is both, it's both me and it's also not me, right? There's a kind of a hybrid situation going on here. Because in the act, as we've been talking about, in the act of writing the self, we are creating something new, creating someone new, someone different, someone who has never been seen before, in a certain sense, but who is coming into view more and more as we write. And this concern about how to authentically represent the self has been a key point in all the studies of spiritual life writing that you can find, you know, all the didactic work that's been done on that, because it's and this is something that we don't really think about, but it's not necessarily the case that the author of a work shares an identity with the narrator within the world of the text. There may be similarities, but they're not identical. They're not identical. They can't be. So when we think about this process, when we think about writing in this way, then what we're doing by creating this narrator, bringing this narrator into view, is we are actually creating an ethical being. And when I say ethical, I mean something very specific here. I mean, we're bringing into view a way of being that is, I guess you could say, living with and for others, right? Well, ethics in this case has to do with how, what kind of a person do we want to be in the world, right? And most of us want to be good people in the world, I think. I would pretty much say everybody in here would agree with that, right? We want to be good people. We want to do something of benefit in the world, whether it's just an, you know, within our own families or whether it's on a larger scale. So the narrator that's being brought into view by our writing is what I would call is a process of ethical formation. So we're not only creating this person, this being, but we are we're forming ourselves as well in that view, in that vision. And this is the dynamic that I'm really interested in with this kind of writing, that as our narrator becomes more and more fleshed out, and as we, you know, begin to learn from that narrator, right? We're going to learn from our narrators because they will have a certain life of their own, even though they're coming into view based on our own memories and our own experiences. there's a dynamic there. There's an interactive dynamic between the I inside the world of the text and the I that we create all the time out here. Does that make sense? There's a dynamic between the I that we create through our writing, which is the I that lives inside the world of the text, and the I that we are constantly creating by telling ourselves, you know, unconsciously, the story of me. There's a communication going on there. And that communication is a formative communication, or it can be. So this is something we're going to explore, but I'm just putting the idea out there. Because really, when you look, it's a bit of a mistake to assume that the narrator within the world of a text is identical to the author. That's a problem, actually. But it's something that is often done with autobiography and with memoir. We just make this assumption. Oh, well, that I within the world of the text must be exactly like the person. But that's not the case, actually. That's not the case. So it's sort of problematizing. Sorry, I have to take this scarf off. That relationship.
So
I think, okay, so now I want to use the microphone if you're going to ask about what we're talking about now, if that's okay.
Okay. Hi, so can we just go back for a moment to the piece about the process of ethical formation?
Yeah.
Okay, so the part about that seems a bit confounding is if we all want to be good people and we're the narrator and we're...
You're not the narrator.
Okay. As an author,
right.
I'm creating a narrator.
Yes.
The narrator is my creation.
Yes.
I'm also creating, because I'm the author creating a narrator. Your point, I think, is you're saying, as an author, it's my responsibility. I'm engaged in a process of ethical formation for the narrator.
Yes.
Okay.
So just as you are in your life, in your daily life, forming yourself.
Yes. Here's the question, though. So how, you see where this goes, right? Like, so how do you, like, that, there's a way in which then, so what? I can just create this fantasy self that is very good?
No. You're basing, the narrator is arising out of as much truth from our own memories as we can regenerate, right? It's not a pure fabrication. It's not a fictional character, complete fictional character. There are going to be dimensions of our stories that are fictional. That's what we were talking about this morning. But you're not, your project, okay, how do I want to say this?
Ethical formation.
The ethical formation is a byproduct. It's not that you are consciously thinking, okay, I am going to make my narrator ethical. So I'm going to make that narrator a really good person. No, your narrator is a human being, right? Ideally, right? it is a fabrication, but it's going through your experiences. You're taking it through your experiences. And that whole process is a formative process that has brought you as the author to where you are today. So I'm putting this out there more as something to hold in the background, not as something to think about when you're writing, oh, I want to make my narrator ethical. It's something that happens as a byproduct of how the story unfolds. I don't know if that makes sense, but I think that's something that will get clearer as we move forward. I see some other questions.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, we're not going, we're not leaping outside the bounds of what we can bring to bear from our memories and from our sense of self and from, you know, we really are trying to write an autobiography. So we're trying to stay as close to truth as we understand it as we can. If that means that, you know, when you describe, you know, a room and you can't exactly remember what the color was on the walls, but you want to flesh that out, you can choose a color, right? But you're not going to diverge from your own process, your own as a person who's gone through life, right? That's where that's where the meat of the story is. You want to stay loyal to that person, right? You want to stay loyal to yourself as you write. I'm just problematizing a little bit the assumption that the author and the narrator are exactly the same. Because as we write these autobiographies, they will take on a life of their own, mm-hmm. right? They will. And so what I'm saying is that there's a kind of process in the writing that forms you more and more and more, because you're exploring how you feel about yourself, how you feel about the world, how you understand your spirituality. You know, you're fleshing out memories, you're bringing things, you're creating a narrative of some form that will take the reader through the text. And really so maybe this is a way to describe it better. As the reader, whoever our readers are, enters into the world of the text that we've created, they will be following the development of this narrator, right? They're going to be following the story of the narrator and what has happened to that person and what they've experienced. And they will be able to observe how that narrator has grown and developed and changed and discovered their spirituality, discovered their path, what they've learned from that, you know, so forth and so on. So it's really more from the perspective of the reader in a way. They will see how that narrator has been formed. And I will put this out there, at the same time, because the reader has willingly entered the world of the text, he, she, or they will be formed themselves by what they read. It will change them. Or maybe, if they're open to it, it will change them. Okay. Does that help make it a little less confounding? No?
Yeah.
Okay, yes.
I raised my hand just because I was so excited by what you were saying.
Oh, okay.
And what I got is that it's a co-creation process, because as the author chooses out of his or her life the parts that she wants in that narrator to have, that's also a process of getting increasingly insight and understanding,
yeah.
that then impacts the author. So as the author is creating the narrator is also creating the author.
Yep, and exactly.
So you blew my mind.
Why don't you come up here and teach this? that's a great way of describing
very,
it.
Very cool. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Yeah.
So I thought you did a brilliant job in your book that came out recently of describing, and I can't, you know, it's probably in the foreword, that some of what you were presenting was real, and you, you know, had really been able to verify it, and some of it, because there were important gaps, that for things to really flow, it would be helpful to have some idea. It was a little bit like magical realism, I think you may have even used that word at one point. You essentially made it up, but it was based on your best guess about what it might have been like at the time.
Right.
So, it was great for me to read that, to hear that, and to have that perspective on the book. And I didn't mind reading it at all. Then, and I can't remember, I don't know if I'm remembering the name of the book right, was it A Million Little Pieces? It was by some guy who...
Oh yeah, A Million Little Pieces.
Yeah. And then it came to be that he had really changed some things and
right.
melded some, and it wasn't even clear if all of it was exactly true. And he got in a lot of trouble.
He got in a lot of trouble, yeah.
Yeah, and so, it of course, it's different in an autobiography than in a biography, but I'm wondering if we find that there are significant places in reaching back that we just can't come up with anything, and yet we do want some, you know, this is what's like, whatever. What's your take on that, and yet still avoiding getting into the situation that he was in?
Well, I mean, this is the moral responsibility we're going to take on, and I don't know exactly what happened with him, this guy who wrote that book, but what I heard was that he had really fully fabricated whole aspects of his life, and then put them forward as if they were true. He did not explain or share that he was creating something fictional. And so that was why he got so much flack for it, I think. I think part of this notion of truth-telling is being completely honest with ourselves about what we're doing. You know, so if we do need to fabricate something, you know, then there might be some interestingly creative ways to signal that to the reader, as I tried to do in the book that I wrote out there, that I was trying to let the reader know from the get-go, you know, this narrative is a creation of mine. It is not coming directly from the autobiography of the saint that I was writing about. Even though I searched for as many clues as I could find in his writing to help me populate that narrative. And anytime he speaks, it is direct from his autobiography is what he himself said. So I think that we have to just, you know, if it feels really important to flesh out something that we can't really remember, then we have to find a way to first of all acknowledge that to ourselves. Okay, now I'm gonna imaginatively recreate this and see how that works. And then if it becomes what we want to keep in the text, we have to signal that somehow to the reader. Or we have to call it something else altogether. You know, it's not an autobiography, it's something different.
This is just getting more and more exciting. I was just so struck by your this whole idea of the being goes into the process of the creative process and then comes out a changed or a transformed being. That every conversation, the design of this retreat is so unusual for a retreat because I'm so used to making up stories about all these people I'm not talking to. And it's become even more weird being online, and they're like flat people, you know. but every conversation I've had in the retreat so far, I've had that experience of going into the conversation and meeting two things. One is listening to the person, and then listening to the habitual story that I tell. And sometimes just stopping right in the middle of it and not wanting to go there. And then coming out the other side with this shift of experience of who I am and definitely who the other person was in terms of my initial impressions.
Right.
So it's just amazing the design of the way you're doing this with us.
Well, that's what I was hoping would happen, because it's true that by opening it up for people to talk to each other, I wanted you to hear, you know, to enter into each other's stories, even though that's through speech at the moment, but also we're doing that through what we've written, right? And you are entering into a story with another person, and so many conversations in our lives can have transformed us, right? We've come out of those conversations feeling different, knowing something different, being inspired, you know, hopefully, or the opposite, but in some way being changed. So I wanted to leave that space open. This isn't a, you know, pure Dharma retreat in the sense of how many of us have done meditation retreats. And that's part of Berry Center for Buddhist Studies, I would say, mission. And one of the reasons I love coming here is that, you know, they've woven together the Dharma with more of an academic or scholastic approach. And so how, you know, in my mind, then this gives me a chance to share some of the more academic or scholastic insights that I gained through my own training, which I don't normally share in a standard meditation retreat because that's not what people are there for. So, you know, I'm hoping that it's resonating with all of you. I want to give you this kind of scaffolding to hang your process on so that we can go deeper, you know, and explore more and see the different dimensions of what we're doing. At least that's what I hope.
For me, what you're describing is so deeply relational.
Yes.
And so the ethical formation or whole making.
That's another great way of describing ethics. Yeah. Whole making.
And that, you know, this interior journey to memory, but it's also to come into contact with parts of myself that lived at one point in time.
That's right.
And that are kind of tucked away in kind of a dissociative place until, like that Zulu phrase, or Paul Ricoeur, when like I see you.
Right.
Like these parts of me, like, oh, like now I'm seen. And
yes.
So, and then the part, it's like, well, I am here. And then that becomes the warp and the weft of.
Yes.
It's more of a true wing rather than a truth telling. Because I'm not telling the truth, like I'm witnessing the unfolding of a conversation so that the parts of me can actually tell a truth.
Right.
And so then there's a kind of a click in something clicks into place and it no longer really matters if it's fact.
Right.
It's whether or not the nobility or the dignity of experience
feels, can be manifested, yeah.
Yes, and feels witnessed and acknowledged, and it's just like a conversation between people.
Right.
You know, and that's where the deep listening is so much about the experience of being listened into being.
Right.
As opposed to journalistically, I got down every word that you said.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Yes, yes, I think that's very much, and actually the model, or a model, that could be a helpful way of just saying pretty much exactly what you said here, is the IFS model, Internal Family Systems model, right? Where you're dialoguing with different parts. We're dialoguing with different parts of ourselves, and those parts may have been silent for a very long time. You know, we're about to start dialoguing with the young self, and that young self has something to share, has something to communicate with us, but can't communicate it until we're willing to open that door. And to, so that's the sort of intra-relational listening that we're doing. And then there is the, you know, inter-relational, which is between ourselves and each other here, right? You know, one person to another, or one person to more than one person. But so it's this deep listening is so key here. We're learning to listen again to these parts of us that have been very quiet, perhaps, for a long time. People who've worked with IFS therapy are probably more, you know, facile with this kind of way of relating to the self as having parts that have, you know, various kinds of communications that they are interested in sharing. So here we're welcoming these parts now to begin to help us weave together the narrative of this spiritual life that we've had. Coming, and I really want to emphasize this description of, because I think this is more relevant than the idea of morals or ethics that we think we understand. You know, I know what that word means. Wholeness. So the ethical formation is the formation of a whole being, a holistic being in a certain sense, right? because if we get caught up in, oh, you know, bad, good, that gets really thick, and also just not as, it can't be as creative, I think. Yeah, Grady.
I know you're eager to get to the drawing exercise, but one question about the practical implications. How does the reader distinguish between an author who naively assumes that he or she is identical to the narrator and one who is not? And one way is in a foreword, as you apparently do in your book. Are there other ways that are clear from the text itself?
So let me make sure I understand your question. Are you asking how the reader can determine the difference between the narrator and the author?
Yes.
I don't think that matters very much. You know, whether the reader has any idea of that distinction. It's much more important for the author to understand that. And actually, though, now that you all know this, it's also important for you to know when you read an autobiography, for example, that the narrator within the world of the text is probably not identical to the actual author who wrote that text. Mm-hmm. But there is a powerful interconnectedness there. It's not like they're entirely different either. Mm-hmm. It's problematic to assume they're exactly the same. That's really the issue there. It limits what's possible. And the fact is, it's not true. They're not the same. Bottom line, they're not the same. But that doesn't mean when we read somebody's autobiography that we don't discover them in a very powerful way. And I know for myself, with that book that I wrote, I spent years inside the world of the text of the autobiography that saint wrote. Years. First of all, because I had to translate it into English, and that took a lot of work. But the more time I spent with the narrator inside the world of that text, the more I felt infused by who that being is. And in a way, I don't even care if the narrator within that text is identical to the Drukpa Kunle who may have been the author. It doesn't matter, because the only way I can know that person is through that text. There is no way, he lived in the 15th century. I can't meet him. Mm-hmm. However, I've also met him through the places where he lived, through the people who still tell his stories, through the you could say, there's a term that was coined by another philosopher, Bernard Faure, imaginaire. The word is imaginaire. A-I-R-E at the end, instead of imagination, but imaginaire. And an imaginaire is a kind of a, it's like the energy that still flows through, make it really concrete. So even though this saint that I spent all this time with lived in the 15th century, there is an energy of him that still permeates the landscape, the hearts and minds of the people who still love him. For them, he's still very much alive, even though, of course, not in a physical form. But they feel very connected to him. And so that energetic presence is what is you would call an imaginaire. And, you know, that's in a certain way what we create when we create our story. We're creating a whole world for the reader to enter into and discover what we've discovered already as an author by creating it. And by the way, I didn't want to bring this up right away, but I did bring more copies of my book. If anyone's interested in buying it, you're welcome to purchase a copy. But there's no credit, you just really don't have to. We bought them for the Wonderwell store, so. So there's, sorry? Oh, well, if anyone who's interested, if anyone's interested, I'll bring them in and we can just do it in the foyer. They're in my car.
My name's Kath. You said we're creating an ethical being by bringing into view a way of being that's about living with and for others. and that ethics is about doing good in the world. Are we avoiding places in our lives that are less than?
Oh, no. No. This isn't about, right? So here's where the difference between hagiography, which is all about how wonderful everything is and how supreme the subject is. No, we are formed, we come to wholeness as a result of all the experiences we've had, the good, the bad, and the ugly, right? In fact, you know, one of the things I was going to talk about if I get there was the shadow. How so much of what forms us as a person in the world comes out of our difficulties, our shadow side. We can learn so much about ourselves when we experience difficulty. In fact, I think we learn more about ourselves when we experience difficulty or challenges or, you know, unsavory dimensions of ourselves than we do when we're just always, you know, happy doing the right thing, right? It's so important to include those parts of ourselves. So I really want to make it clear that this is not about whitewashing our lives and presenting some kind of perfect picture. Not at all, right? We're talking about full humanness, becoming a full human being, a whole human being. And a whole human being has all kinds of experiences. But what makes that human being able to become free of themselves is the level of awareness that we can bring to everything that we've experienced. So, you know, and we may discover as we resurrect these different parts of our lives, including the really difficult things, how much we learned as we went through that experience, how much we changed, how much shifted for us in our lives. You know, if we lost somebody we loved, or if we did something really awful and then had to live with the, you know, the fallout from that, can be an enormously powerful learning experience. And those learning experiences are what move us along our path. Right? So you're not, this is not about, whitewashing our lives.
I was just confused by the emphasis on ethics as doing good in the world.
Okay, well, I think I probably should retract that. That is a particular definition of ethics that, again, comes from this Paul Ricoeur, where he describes ethics as living well with and for others. He puts that out there as a kind of, you know, just, I don't know what the word is, but just a way of thinking about what it would mean to be in relationship, being in relationship in a way that is positive, living well. But what does it mean to live well? Right? We need to actually break that up. What does it mean to live well for you? For each of us, it's not going to be the same thing necessarily. And we live well for ourselves, to take care of ourselves, and we live well to take care of others who we love. Right? You look puzzled.
It's complicated.
Of course it is. It's very complicated. It's very complicated, and that complexity is one of the things that is so helpful to include in our stories, right? Because being a human being is complicated. We do things that cause harm that we had no intention of doing, of causing harm, right? And yet it does. You know, I think of the way I grew up with my sister, we're Irish twins. She's like 1 year, not even a year younger than I am. And I have an idea of what happened in our childhood. But recently she's been around a lot more because of my parents, and we have really unearthed some pretty intense stuff. And I've discovered that many things that I did caused a lot of harm for her, and vice versa. But to really bring those things out into the light of day and talk about them together has been enormously healing. And we've been able to really let go of them, but they had to be acknowledged. Right, they had to be, but at the time that I was a child, I had no idea. I didn't know that I was hurting her, you know, by being the one who had to, you know, whenever we played games, I had to make the game up. She was not allowed to make the game up, because I'm older, right? You know, and that was hard for her. She felt diminished because of that. And that's just one example. There are lots and lots of lots of things. But it's not been an easy year. But I'm so grateful that we've been able to be in dialogue in that way and willing, both of us, to face into the truth of what really hurts. You know, so that I could hear her tell me, that hurt me so much, and feel her hurt. And I could say the same thing back to her. And I think, you know, those are the places where now I can think, wow, you know, there's a real shift in our relationship, there's a shift in our understanding of each other, and there's a shift in our understanding of ourselves. I would call that a spiritual transformation for us. I really would. So it is complicated, right? It's very complicated. And that's something we'll have to grapple with as we try to write. But that's why I wanted to really retract this idea that, you know, we're just trying to showcase ourselves in the best possible light. You know, no. Who's gonna relate to that? Right? Like, yawn. No, this, I think, I feel personally that this process is a process of looking very deeply into our lives and into who we are now and how we've become the I that I am now. Right? There is some kind of continuity there. There are developments and changes and growths and insights and shifts that have happened, many, many. So can we begin to identify those and to describe them? Because if we can, then whoever might read what we write will also experience that as they go through it. And we will experience it, right? We'll re-experience and have new insight and deeper realization into who we are and how we are in relationship, I think. Yes.
My name is Eiko.
Hi, Eiko.
Hi. So for truth, with the topic of truth-telling, I think a lot about the implication for the other people that I'm writing about.
Right.
And the creation of them as a character.
Yes.
And with my work, I'm actually calling it autofiction. It's been suggested to me that I should just call it straight-up memoir, but the line between the two is actually almost non-existent, really.
Right.
Sometimes people just use autofiction, sometimes they use memoir. I feel in the process of writing, it gives me like a different spirit to call it autofiction. I quite like that. But anybody who reads the book will know who these people are.
Right.
You know, and some of it is quite uncomfortable for the other person, and I'm still involved in like the same, like one takes place at a meditation center that's still my primary sangha. It has been, they're like my family.
Right.
And I think to uncover some of that stuff has moral implications, even though it happened, it just has moral implications now and for the new life that this person and other people have created.
Right.
You know what I mean? But it was such an important part of my life. So then I'm sort of like thinking, well, I think that's why it's such a, I've had so much difficulty writing that chapter.
Yeah.
Something just feels so fake about it. But it's like, that's the reality. And I think autofiction gives me like this little thing where I could actually really fictionalize it, but then I actually can't fictionalize it. Like it needs
right.
to be real. And that also, like with my family, because of course some of this involves my family as well, it's like, I have responsibilities to my mother, to my brother, to like, to everybody. And like my teacher is such an important part of my life, but it's sort of like in Zen we have dokusans, which is like private interviews. And then also to be disclosing like private interviews, it feels like ethical implications all around. So
right. Well, and so this is, I mean, it's a great, great question. And it's one that we're all going to be balancing. Because, and actually, one of the ways to, there's a very interesting teaching by the Buddha about exactly this. He's giving a teaching to his monks, and he's talking about right speech. And in what he says is that if you can tell the truth in a way that does not cause harm and is at the right time, that it can be heard so as to be, you know, helpful, then tell the truth. If, however, telling the truth will cause harm, more harm, let's say, and it's not at the right time, then don't tell it. So it's very interesting. He doesn't just say, yeah, just say it. Just say the truth regardless. Because, of course, the basic tenet of the Buddhist path is non-harm, right? However, then there's the it's complicated, as Kath says, right? Is there more harm by holding back some of these truths, or harms that get drawn out and perpetuated because the truth isn't known? You know, I can say that for all the years between the time I was booted out of my sangha and the time where it was possible to actually tell the truth in a way that it could be heard, a lot more harm happened during that time. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot more harm. But there was no opportunity, there was no opening for that truth to be told until very recently. So it is complicated because we do want to share. I mean, I think that in a way we first write for ourselves, right? What do I need to say here? And then we can go back through and try to make sense of, is it okay to say this right now in a way that's going to be public? I need to say it for myself. And maybe at some point it's going to be fine to have it be available to everybody. But that's part of this notion of truth-telling, is to begin to really discriminate between what is going to be of some benefit, even if what is read is very difficult and very painful, or what is said is very difficult and very painful, or is it going to simply, become more harmful? Is more harm going to be created? I mean, that's an open question that we have to explore, I think. You know, I mean, I can think of all kinds of things I'd like to write about my father, but I don't want him to read those things. But I need to say them. You know, I don't see any benefit in him reading those things. If I thought they might change him, then maybe I would think about how to say them in a way that he could hear them. That kind of thing, right? You know, it really is going to be it's not an easy thing to write about one's own life, because there is so much truth that we're representing, and those truths can be beneficial and they can be very, very painful. I mean, I think in a certain sense, you know, telling the truth can set us free, right? In a certain sense, in ourselves, can set us free in ourselves. But it's only if we can engage in that truth-telling with a very direct and a very almost kind of radical self-exposure to ourselves, of the self to the self. Because if we can't be completely true with ourselves, honest, let's say honest, maybe this word true is not helping. If we can't be completely honest with ourselves about who we are, what we've done, our actions, how they've been, how we've caused harm when we didn't want to, then how are we going to be, you know, really genuine and authentic with others or in our writing? So the level of truth-telling here that is most important is the truths that we reveal to ourselves. Not so much what we put in the autobiography, though of course that's important, right? So, you know, I would say that sometimes we have an obligation not to tell the full truth, because there may be things we do need to leave out if they're going to cause harm, at least, or leave them out for now. right? But there's no, I would say the imperative here is really about self-care and self-kindness. It's like, it's such a hard thing for all of us to really care about ourselves and love ourselves. And that, I think, I also would like to bring that forward as a really, as an emphasis, that can we engage this project with the energy of kindness towards the self, right? We're not here to chastise ourselves for the mistakes we made or the ways we harmed others, right? That's not what this is about. But it is a willingness to expose ourselves to ourselves and to see what's there, to see what we've done, not to beat ourselves up about it, but to simply confirm in a way to ourselves that that's not what we want to do, that's not how we want to live. And then you go forward, and then we go forward. It's not dwelling on, I'm such a terrible person. We've all done things that we regret. I'd be surprised if there was anyone who has not done something they regret, or said things we regret, or, you know, whatever. But I think the habit pattern in our cultural context is to take that all the way down the road, you know. That means I'm a bad person. There's something wrong with me, you know, for some of us anyway, if you have that very strong inner critic, likely coming from having been criticized externally, right? And then you internalize that voice. So, okay, well, so I think just to end this for the moment, I mean, this is a conversation I think will continue, right? But just to say at the moment, it's what's important here is for us to begin to ascertain what aspects of our lives are safe to share, safe for us, but maybe safe for those we love too, right? That won't cause more harm. That won't cause more harm. And then to take some kind of control of our narratives by deciding what we want to share and what we don't want to share. Like, we have all the control in the world of that. Nobody's forcing us to say what we don't want to say. But I think that this process is a very deep process of self-inquiry and self-dialogue. So, you know, yeah. Let's take a break and come back at 3:20. So we have a full 15-minute break, okay?
What time are we doing the partners?
I'm sorry?
What time are we doing the partners for the drawing?
So that'll be at 4:30.
Okay.
So 4 to 4:30, you do your diagram, and then from 4:30 to 5, yeah, meet with your partner.